a classic interview by the late Kelia Ramirez Watson with independent scholar of suppressed women's histories, Max Dashew.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Women's studies did not exist at Harvard University in 1969 when Ms. Max Dashew studied linguistics and anthropology there. She found that anthropologists assumed that women had always been dominated by men. So Dashew became an independent feminist scholar in women's history, reading everything she could on the subject for 34 years. Along the way, Dashew has accumulated 14,000 to 16,000 slides of female images. Dashew gives slideshows on what she calls suppressed histories, which tell the female side of the human story. In her years of study, Dashew has found that human culture has not always been patriarchal in all places. She has found more egalitarian, woman-centered cultures, not in some mythical golden age of feminism, but right now, in our own times, all over the world. Cultures in which there are no illegitimate children, no battery or marital rape, and in which gay people are more tolerated because there are not the rigid gender roles found in patriarchy. Today's matrix societies, as Dashew calls them, are not patriarchy in reverse, but a totally different paradigm. They are indigenous cultures that have survived centuries of colonization by patriarchal societies. Wings talked to Dashew in mid-November of 2003. We began by having her define her terms.
I don't use the word matriarchal because it implies to too many people a reverse of patriarchy, just a mirror image of domination switched over onto the female side. I think that we're talking about an entirely different paradigm. I say matrix society, or else I'll say mother right culture. Matrix I like because it is a word that is related to our word for mother. And, you know, matrilineal is implied, matrilocal. Some of the features of these egalitarian societies are described. But it goes even beyond that to some of the most profoundly held values of these cultures, which is the life support system. That is a matrix. This really is reflective to me of the different values. They're not about ranking and hierarchy, but instead they're about communal reciprocal exchange. They're about grounding the values of the culture around nurturance rather than domination.
What do matrilineal and matrilocal mean?
Matrilineal means that descent is traced in the maternal line, inheritance going through from the mother to the children. And why this is significant is that it provides a structural support for the fact that women bear and raise children. If you're going to insist on structuring society around descent from the father, then you have to know who the father is, and then there has to be enforcement enacted against women's sexuality in order to make sure that that social structure is upheld. And so what we've seen from that historically is that all kinds of violent repression against women have been brought about in order to ensure that patrilineal descent. Matrilocal means that the family is centered around the woman and her kin. She doesn't go as a stranger into another family where she has no protection against marital rape or battering or some of the other things that happen in patriarchal societies. Really, too, the values of these societies are, in general, against aggressive behavior and violence toward women or toward anyone. I mean, the values for men as well are something that, you know, harmonious relations are valued. Peggy Sande talks about this in her studies with the Minangkabau people. They talk a lot about gentle behavior and harmony being the basis of desirable social relations. And you'll see this repeated among the Machigenga in South America, the Vanatine in Melanesia, many other of these matrix societies. We're looking nowadays really at all the societies that have egalitarian matrilineal systems are indigenous cultures. This is something that I think we also have to bring forward, not only the second wave feminist research, but we have to also look at indigenous testimony about the social values of their cultures, not all indigenous cultures, but the ones which are gender egalitarian. And this is where I think it's really critical to look at writers like Barbara Alice Mann, who is an Ohio Six Nations woman who's written a book called Iroquoian Women, The Gontoesis. And she really lays out how structural power for women is embedded in Haudenosaunee culture, the Iroquois cultures. We especially have to elevate the indigenous narratives of American, African, Pacific history and see what they have to say about their own history. That has to be put forward in a way that it has not. It has to be foregrounded. Before we get to theory, we have to look at facts. We have to look for the information and evaluate it, because as far as I'm concerned, this is all very much a remedial study. And it is impacted not only by bias against feminine power, but it is really heavily influenced by the strong Eurocentric bias of so much of the classic academic discipline.
Early 21st century, do we have around the world existing matrix societies?
Yes. Yes, there are still some after all this time. We can look at the Tuareg in North Africa. There's actually quite a few pockets of matrix cultures in Southeast Asia. People that speak Austroasiatic languages, especially the Khasi in what's now northeastern India. You've got the Moswo culture in Yunnan province. And there's actually Yunnan, which is an area of southwest China that's kind of wedged between Tibet, Burma, and China. Highland region has a very marked leaning towards equality for women. There's a range of different culture styles, and some are matrilineal and others are bilateral, but you see a lot of indicators of female freedom in that region of the world. And then Vanuatu, little island northeast off the coast of Australia, they have been written about in the last 10 years as having almost complete equality between women and men. And again, the values being very much focused on harmonious relations and giving, exchange of gifts. In what's now the U.S. Empire, you have the matrilineages of the southwestern desert, the Pueblo societies of Arizona and New Mexico. The Iroquois are still around, the Six Nations, and of course the Navajo as well in the southwest. There's a variety of different cultures, and there's really a range. There's a researcher named Shan Shan Du, who has written a book about the Lahu people in Yunnan, and she makes a really good point, which is that academia has been very quick to describe any society that has any patriarchal elements as a patriarchy or as a male-dominated culture, but is very reluctant to describe egalitarian cultures. They have to be perfect, or else they're not egalitarian. And I think with human beings, you're never going to see perfect, but you can see really big differences in the way society is put together, and that's what I'm trying to look at. There is a huge distance between the Hopi and the Nazis, you know, so I don't think it's an unrealistic or non-objective viewpoint to investigate the variety of different kinds of human societies that have existed and to look at how social structures uphold certain political values and certain power relations. I don't feel that study has been undertaken in an objective way. There's a range of behaviors. There are some matrilineal societies that are patrilocal, so the woman goes to live with the man's family. And in those situations, you tend to see a drop in status for women, even though it's still matrilineal. The severance of women and children from the maternal kin has an effect that is not positive for women in many cases. And one other point about the way these systems work is that another really big difference is that the matrix cultures tend to be the way that men relate into these systems is as brothers, as uncles, as sons, rather than as fathers and as husbands. It's not to say there's no role for fathers and husbands, but that is not their primary linked to their kinships, so that you see a sister-brother pair very often. And this turns up in the oral traditions and also shows up often in the way that authority operates in the society. In order to have a husband in control, that's really a legal tie. It's not a blood tie. And that has a lot of consequences for female status.
Of the cultures existing today, what you know of, which are the ones that you think are most favorable toward women?
Well, the Moswo are right up there. I can't find any indicators of patriarchal culture in their society. This is Moswo in Yunnan, Southeast Asia. That's very dramatic. The Tuareg are also pretty impressive. They're in the center of the Sahara. They're a pretty widespread group of people. In the Middle Ages, we already have Islamic writers remarking on the extremely high status and honor given to women. They lack a sexual double standard. And you can even just see from looking at the women, the way the women move their bodies, that, you know, they don't have the shame that's been inculcated in patriarchal cultures. They have a certain freedom about them. And then Minangkabau are like that too in Sumatra, Western Indonesia. They have just a bearing and a dignity in their bodies that shows you there's a sovereignty, a female sovereignty that you can perceive in those cultures. With the Tuareg, it's not the women who veil, it's the men who veil their faces. The reason that the males veil is that it actually signifies the withholding of aggression or threatening behavior. It signifies this idea that the male will not act out in violent ways.
You would think agriculture has made the male physique important and woman was necessary for childbearing and to have workers, and so that's all they cared about with her. And yet these indigenous cultures, as you've talked about, that are matrix societies, are low-tech, do depend on physical labor. Why is it that some societies have gone mother right while others have gone patriarchal?
The physical difference, I think, you know, even if you want to talk about agriculture, a lot of the matrix societies are farming societies. What they are not is plantation, feudal, serfdom societies. They're not peasants who are using plows to farm vast areas of land whose produce is then largely handed over in tribute to lords. They're much more local cultures, and it's very common worldwide to see women involved in food production. So a lot of our ideas about the physical strength aspect in agriculture, I think, are assumptions that need to be reexamined, because, you know, if you look even in patriarchal societies in South and East Asia, women are the ones out there in the rice paddies, you know, in the midday sun, doing really heavy backbreaking work. Some anthropologists think that it's important to draw this distinction between these much more local communal clan societies and the sort of mass agricultural societies, which are much more ranked not only by gender but also through class systems. And that's one factor we have to look at when we're thinking about how do these systems of domination arise, because you see very quickly that there's a correlation between domination by gender and domination by class or conquest or ethnicity, caste systems, things like that. For example, if you look at some of the most dramatic constraints that have been enacted on female bodies, you know, the foot binding, the European corset, a lot of those, even the veil, if you look back to its historical origins, seclusion and confinement of women begin with upper classes. The Roman patricians is another example, because patrician actually means the class of the father. And the Romans drew this distinction that the patricians were the patriarchal class, and the plebeians, they said, often did not even know who their fathers were. So there was still female sexual liberty among the lower classes to some degree. The patriarchal system is something artificial that devolved. It's not an evolutionary model. I don't think that there are iron cast stages in the mode of old anthropological theory. But you can definitely see a historical trend toward patriarchy. In India, the Mahabharata talks about matrilineal cultures that existed in ancient times, and it also refers to polyandry, women taking multiple husbands. And in fact, the heroes of the Mahabharata are five men married to one woman. So you can see indicators of more widespread different patterns, more variation than we know today in a mostly male-dominated world. And you can see this in process sometimes as well, because you see cultures which are maybe still matrilineal, but the brother, the uncle is starting to get authority over the women, the residence with the husband separates the woman from her kin, and you start to see a diminution of women's status. So there's a lot to be looked at, and I don't think we can come up with any one set of dates or any one way that this all happened, because human society is just too complex and diverse. There's so many historical factors that there's actually a whole range of things we have to look at, not only matrilineage and matrilocality, but women's political and economic and diplomatic and spiritual leadership, the female shamans and the priestesses that you still see even in patrilineal societies. Those are significant things to be looked at as well.
You are listening to Wings, talking with Max Dashew about Mother Right, egalitarian matrix societies.
Another thing I would think would be associated with patriarchy is the military.
That is one way that you see a shift to patriarchal systems is through conquest. Sometimes it evolves from within a culture, sometimes it happens through conquest, and sometimes it happens through a combination. In other words, some peoples who were conquered, say in Native North America, were already patrilineal, but they weren't nearly as patriarchal as the European invaders. It gets really complicated in some ways, but in terms of, say, for example, the Pueblo cultures, they were militarily overrun first by the Spanish, then by the Anglos. And I think the reason we see so much survival as we do is partly because there were the Pueblo revolts against the Spanish in the 17th century. And so you had a very strong movement in defense of the indigenous culture. Military organization is something that also tends to, over time, privilege males, you know, males as warriors, and it tends to centralize the society so that instead of having councils of elders and maybe a balance of power between the men's council and the women's council, you begin to see the need for a military commander to fight enemies, and then that makes the society grow much more hierarchical and authoritarian.
The role of churches, too. The Roman Catholic Rite was patriarchal, whereas the Irish Celtic Christianity was very honoring of women for a long time. Did the Roman Rite, actually centered in Roman culture, bring its patriarchy to the Irish?
Oh yeah, sure it did. And even the Irish Church was influenced by that, because the scriptures they were drawing on, I mean, you have the Pauline mandates for women to be silent and obey husbands and all of that. So even the native Irish church had some of those elements. But you're right, the patriarchal, really the imperial Roman Church was something that really consolidated a lot of very strong values of male domination that were from the entire Mediterranean region, that from the time of the pagan Roman Empire, and then beyond that, all of these ideas became consolidated into a religious ideology that barred women from the priesthood, that blamed females for, you know, the sexual fall of humankind, the concepts of original sin. All of that led to not only structural oppression being carried out against European women as Europe was gradually decreed Christian by one ruler after another, but it also acted in a deeper way, which I see as the internal colonization of women, to the point that if you can get women to believe that they ought to obey their husbands, that they ought to be subject to men, then you don't even need as much the external enforcement, because you get the enforcement going inside women's own psyches. They actually break themselves, they silence themselves, because they're taught in those ways. And it also creates a division between women, you know, based on these kinds of values, the authority of the priest and the husband, the Lord, also shoring up those class systems.
Okay, so the things that lead us away from matrix societies and mother right, we can say, are imperialism, militarism, a style of agriculture that emphasizes plantation over local agriculture. What about industrialization? I noticed that the matrix societies that we seem to have still with us today are in what we would call the global south, which is less industrialized.
Yeah, industrialization and class systems in general, I think. But industrialization certainly has accelerated that and also what they're calling globalization, but is just the, you could call it the final stage of imperialism, mean that not only the matrix societies, but all indigenous cultures are under severe threat for their land base, for their culture, their language, everything. I mean, just surviving on any of those levels has become really, really hard. And you look at examples like some of the Niger Delta people, the Ijaw woman that protested by taking over the Shell oil platforms. They have some very strong matrifocal elements in their culture, and they actually used those as a basis for their uprising against the corporate oil interests. The Machigenga people in the Andean Amazon region are also matrilineal culture who are finding themselves really threatened by the poisoning of their land by the oil companies who have really just ravaged so much of South America.
Do we see a reaction to this globalization and this industrialization that is leading us back to the matrix society?
Yeah, I think that one thing that is very clear is, and this is part of what happened with, you know, the 20th century, late 20th century wave of women's movements, is that there became a very strong imperative to try and look for ways to restructure culture, you know, to look for models and to see whether, in fact, there were human societies that weren't based on domination and repression. There's been both a political and a spiritual movement to try and understand more about those societies and also to try and reinvent a culture that is based on cooperation, on unifying against these really mass corporate powers, against the structures of male privilege that are still so deeply embedded in the quote-unquote Western societies and many others as well.
The recent destruction of national treasures from Iraq, has that hurt the scholarship of matrix societies of the Middle East region?
I think so. I think it's hurt the study of all Iraqi history. There was just a tremendous amount that either was destroyed or ripped off, and not only in the bombings, but actually, ever since the first invasion, the first bombings of Iraq that began in the early 90s, you have a mass looting that had already begun of archaeological sites. So those are never going to be able to be studied systematically because the artifacts are going to just show up out of context. We're not going to be able to date them according to stratigraphy and really get a contextual setting for them. Generally, when people talk about ancient Iraq, they're thinking about the Sumerians and the Babylonians. And one of the things that I've been looking at in recent years is really going back to the very, very old Neolithic cultures in Iraq that existed anywhere from 8,000 to 6,000 years ago, before the rise of the empires or the hierarchical states in Mesopotamia. Those are pretty striking, not only in Iraq, but also in places like Pakistan, number of other ancient societies that have been studied. You see that as you go back into those pre-state eras, you start to find households which seem to be organized collectively. The primary iconography is centered around the female. You know, this seems very likely that there was a matrilineal descent system going on in these cultures. There's been a big argument about that. You know, how to interpret those female images that are so prominent in these very ancient societies. But I think people have to have an open mind about this. The ideology that was prevalent when I was in college, and it's still very much around, is to call them fertility idols, dancing girls, concubines, you know, really sort of projecting the values of the society that we live in onto these ancient cultures. It doesn't really fit.
Why doesn't it fit?
Because some people have tried to compare these images to Barbie dolls. You know, the whole focus of the figurines is much more around the sacred. They're often found in contexts like burials, which is not normally where you would look for either children's toys or, you know, things like Barbie dolls, or as some of the other theories have had it, as pornography. This is just ancient pornography. The sacramental context is quite clear. And, you know, they're often found in shrines and in temples. So that, I think that has to be taken into account. Granaries, too, which, you know, if you look at animistic cultures, having one of these images of basically what look like life givers or maternal ancestors, in my view, having that in there amongst the grain, that is very congruent with what modern people still talk about, the corn mothers, you know, the life-giving aspect of the earth mother. And so I think that really, rather than using the theoretical constructs of, you know, Western anthropology, these very rationalistic and very patriarchal-oriented interpretations, we really need to look, again, to the more recent societies that still have had similar kinds of cultural patterns and see what they say about these things.
What does matrilineal or matrix society mean for gay people?
Well, a lot of these cultures actually did not have a rigid barrier of gender roles. In other words, there was women's work and men's work. Very much they had different assignments for that. But from what I've seen, the barrier was permeable, so that you could have, you know, men who wanted to weave could go over and, you know, be with the women, and women who wanted to be warriors or hunters could go over with the men. They could marry women, or the men could, you know, have male partners. And so you have a much more pronounced degree of tolerance, and I'm speaking generally, but this is a pattern, than there is in patriarchal cultures, which really try to enforce gender differences in a very systematic way.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Researching women's history, really bringing out the positive heritages and achievements of women, is completely united and actually indivisible from the indigenous studies, from looking at the world from the point of view of people who have in recent centuries been invaded and conquered, you know, have been dominated by more powerful military, industrial societies, class societies. I think there's a lot that goes together there, because the same kinds of silences, the silences about the local native communal cultures, really converge with the silences about societies where women had power. They're the same societies in so many cases. And so there's ways in which racism and sexism converge in the way we have been taught, you know, or what really we have not been told about the full range of human experience.
That was Kellya Ramirez Watson's 2003 interview with Max Dashew. Max Dashew has continued to research and organize astonishing images and information about matrifocal cultures past and present. Her website is suppressedhistories.net. That's all one word, suppressedhistories.net. Her many courses of study can be found at teachable.com. That's suppressed-histories.teachable.com. Wings thanks our supporters, including your community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose recent events can be found at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. For more about Wings, email wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Vancouver Art Gallery presents Fashion Fictions, an exhibition which surveys experimental design practices that exist at the intersection of fashion and other modes of cultural production, until October 9th, 2023. The designers in fashion fictions occupy liminal spaces such as fact and fiction to use fashion as a means to unite seemingly disparate sentiments and to propose new possibilities for aesthetics, bodily forms, and more ambitiously, how we exist in the world. To learn more about this exhibition, visit fanartgallery.bc.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.